This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew. Craig, when's the last time you went out to the club?
To the club?
Yeah, the club.
It's been a long time since I went to the club. I can't remember. I think, honestly, the last time somebody checked my ID was when you and I went to a barcade a few weeks ago.
We did.
That's
the last time I went to a club or anything like it, too, because we were surrounded by people who, like, were going out. And I'm like, I remember going out because we were just, like, there for the games, really.
Yep,
like,
we were.
We were there to play weird Japanese music rhythm arcade games and to hang out. But other people were there to, like, to be there and then to go to a second location after they had been there. And that is not what we were. That was not our vibe.
I cannot fathom doing that. Mm-hmm. It was a fun experience.
It was a fun club.
Yeah, but it did have club energy, which
it did
I was
have
not
club
expecting.
Energy, even though we did not sip any bub. I mean, beer has bubbles, but it's not, when people talk about bub colloquially, that's not what they mean.
True. That is true. I mean, there are lots of, you're kind of like a bub.
How so?
Like, hey, bub.
Okay, sure. Yes, yes. That's, I am like that.
Yeah. Bottle, but you, the
out
bottles
were
not full
of you. Out
at the
club hanging with my bub.
Welcome to our Book Bub podcast, where each week one of us reads a book and tells the other one about it. This week, I read Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe. It is,
and you really read it this week.
Yeah, I did. In fact,
not like it. Last week where we did a joke.
I don't know what you're talking about. I definitely read that book. It was called Peace and Conflict.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yes, this week I definitely and actually factually read the book Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe. It's a book that's been on my radar since we first covered her work on episode 466. I read the book Ash, which is her 2009 debut.
Oh, yeah.
And then this book had either just come out or was coming out shortly after that episode.
Do you have the episode date pulled up? Because this was published in 2021.
I think the episode was around 2021.
I think in the 400s that would make sense.
March 29, 2021, it says here. So pretty close. And it, you know, this one won the National Book Award for young adult literature, and so been kind of meaning to get back to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good read. So,
and here we are. We did it.
Yeah. What do we need to recontextualize ourselves with on Lowe, Andrew, before I tell you about the book?
Sure. Just in brief, she's an American novelist. She was born in China, moved to the U.S. around age 3. Her writing career began in blogs and magazines. She started writing for a site called After Ellen in 2003. Now, this is, if you are not 100 years old like we are,
blog.
This is a site primarily for gay and bi women, and the name is a reference to Ellen DeGeneres, who came out, and it was sort of a watershed moment for it being, like, acceptable to be gay in public.
Just unbelievable.
Like, it's kind of wild.
I saw that in her history, and I was like, you called your blog After Ellen, which, like, I get it, but also, wow.
I always like, well, sometimes you just, you know, a place has a name and then you look up why the name exists, or like you remember why the name exists and you dissolve into dust, like the left-leaning organization MoveOn.org. Do you know what they were moving on from?
It wasn't George Bush, was
it? No, it was the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Oh, my God. Sure.
So she wrote for After Ellen, and she wrote for Curve in the 2000s. Her first novel, Ash, was published in 2009, yep. As you mentioned. If you don't remember that or you didn't listen to the episode, it was a reimagining of Cinderella, center on a lesbian teenager. She's gay. There's an essay on her site about coming out, about having had a mostly happy relationship with a man before coming out, and about sexual fluidity. This is pretty foundational to her body of work, just like her...
Yeah.
Sexual identity.
Yeah.
From an Autostraddle interview with her about this book, she says, "I've certainly wanted to write about queer girls and women in every genre. I'm very deliberately putting characters like me in the narratives in these different genres. That's a goal of mine, the genre thing. It's so interesting because I think people find it unusual that I write in so many different genres. But as a reader, I read everything. So it's not like I only read one kind of book. And I think I bring a reader's perspective to writing that in the different genres." So yeah, and then the other thing I wanted to talk about her website is she has one of those like obligatory newsletter sign up pop up things.
Yeah.
But the little heading for it says "Lo and Behold," which is almost good enough that I had signed
up.
Very
good.
It's pretty good.
It's my understanding that those things are actually very important.
Oh yeah. Not knocking her, but I'm just saying, you know,
no.
she made the most of the opportunity she was given.
That's pretty good.
Her other books include Huntress in 2011, Adaptation in 2012, and its sequel Inheritance in 2013, A Line in the Dark in 2017, This Telegraph Club in 2021. And then A Scatter of Light in 2022, which is described as a quote standalone companion novel to Telegraph Club rather than a proper like sequel slash prequel slash squeakquel slash threequel.
I think there is a reference to two of the main characters from this book in that one. I know it is set. So this book, as we'll discuss, is set in the 1950s primarily. And it's my understanding that A Scatter of Light is set in and around 2013, around when same-sex marriage is legalized in California. So I think there's like a through line reference to some of the characters in this book.
And I think some of the research that she did for this book, I'm sure informed.
Oh, yeah.
Not that I know anything about that book, but I did read about some of her process for researching this, and it just sounds like it's all intertwined.
Yeah, yeah. This book... As I mentioned, it received the National Book Award for Young Literature. They said that it was the first time a book with an LGBT woman as the main character has won that particular award. It also received the Stonewall Book for YA Lit, the Asian Pacific American Award for Youth Lit, and the Michael Prince Award, which is the Teen Lit Award from Booklist magazine. I don't know what you found, Andrew. I'll just kind of give a quick overview of some things from her author's note about where the like research for this book came from.
Yeah, do the author's note. I'll also say that she did a series of like 7 or 8 blog posts, I think, on her website
like
called
Notes
from the
yes.
Telegraph
okay.
Club. And I did read a couple of those, including the one that, because you shared a couple of questions you wanted me to read about as research stuff. And she did one called Finding Queer Asian America in the Margins.
Oh yeah.
We can talk about a bit. But yeah, tell me about the author's note.
So I was struck by the way that this book positions for lack of a better word, capital H history. Like, it is a book about a couple of characters going through relationships. And Ooh. Then they
tell me more.
Well, and I
you should
that,
write. You should write Dust Jacket. Blur.
I mean that in the most positive way. And when you said that she writes with that she brings a reader's perspective, that really struck me as like what is going on in this book. That is like a YA coming of age novel about a queer character who is like discovering what it is to be in a relationship, and like the beats that she hits from a plot perspective could map to any number of coming-of-age, relationship-driven story, especially one that happens to have queer characters in it. But the way that she weaves all of that into a historical novel is really driven by all the research she did, but it doesn't overburden the story. So then when I got into the author's note, and she's like, here's the bajillion amounts of research I did, I was like, wow, that's pretty elegant that most of this is not like... you know, making the page really heavy and like cumbersome.
I think that's why she wrote so many of these blog posts, is she just had like a lot of stuff that she wanted to get out but couldn't fit it into the book. Even in interviews that she did, and a couple that I read, she told the same anecdote about reading about like people in the women's department in Macy's in the 50s and how they were just like all lesbians.
Oh yeah.
And she really liked that fact but couldn't fit it into the book, but does like to mention it whenever it's even like kind of germane to whatever interviewer she's talking to.
So the research she name checks, she talks about two books, Rise of the Rocket Girls and Wide Open Town. Rise of the Rocket Girls, she shouts out mainly as a source for women in mathematics and engineering and science. Couple of the main character, Lily, goes on to, after the book ends, to work in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, all that stuff that's going to lead to NASA and stuff like that. And then Wide Open Town, I believe, is largely about queer history in San Francisco, and that's a huge part of the book. Those two books informed a short story that she wrote called New Year, which came out in 2018 in a collection, All Out, The No Longer Secret Stories of Queer Teens. And then she was, I don't know if it was her editor that told her or she was just encouraged or whatever to kind of spin it out into a full novel. But here's a bunch of the stuff she talks about, like working its way into this book. She uses a lot of contemporaneous language on purpose, things like referring to, multiple characters referring to Chinese folks as Orientals, that is like throughout the book. She includes different written Chinese dialects in Chinese characters to reflect Mandarin and Cantonese and words that are a mix of English and Chinese, and they have footnotes for when she writes exclusively in Chinese, which I think her rule was that if it was a complete thought or a complete sentence, she wrote it in Chinese characters. And then has like a footnote, which is pretty elegant, works pretty well. She also talks about how the lesbian characters we meet use like butch and femme in ways that like maybe younger queer folks may or may not be on board with today, but it's like part of the language of the folks at this time. And she's pretty upfront about the fact that she's like, I'm just reflecting how these characters move through their world. And it's not dogmatic. It's it's history kind of.
Well, and my understanding of the way those terms and other like related terms have evolved is just like as more people have become familiar with,
the
terminology and been using it more, like it's gotten more specific.
Yes. Yes. Her point is that she doesn't use it to imply the necessity of a binary, but just that the characters at the time may have viewed it as more of a binary than we would today, sort of thing. She also talks about the history of kind of anti-Chinese sentiment at the time. There's a prominent doctor, Su Shenxian, who was a founding member of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who is then deported in the mid-50s as part of the Red Scare and all sorts of stuff like that. That is a big pressure on the novel. She talks about the history of lesbian pulp novels. There's a lesbian pulp novel that Lily finds in a drugstore, like a thrift store, where she, I think, Lo talks about in the afterwards is like, you could have these novels that had lesbian characters in them, but they always needed to be punished at the end due to, like, obscenity laws or whatever. Right. And this book, interestingly, has a structure where there is an epilogue where our primary characters who are in a relationship get to be happy and connected to one another. But just before that, it is kind of a bummer of an ending to a story where a character, Lily is not quite punished, but is like removed from her situation against her will.
Sure.
And it does feel like Lo is aware of that trope and then is, taking the step to correct it via historical analog sort of thing. And then she's also just very aware of all the other history of Chinese folks in and Chinese American folks in San Francisco, the history of the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the fact that she says in 1906 there was an earthquake that destroyed all sorts of public documents. So then Chinese folks immigrating would use fabricated papers to claim that they were the sons of Chinese, you know, the sons and daughters of Chinese people already living in America, so that they mm-hmm. could beat the Exclusion Act quota.
Right.
Which, you know, there's all sorts of pressures on the Chinese folks in this book related to post-war anti-communist sentiment. That is never the main driver of plot in the book, but is just kind of there to explain why characters behave the way they do.
Sure, yeah.
And then the last thing is I'll just read this closing paragraph from the author's note. She has name-checked a number of women that she did research on, a Chinese-American lesbian who grew up in Chinatown, a Chinese-American doctor, an activist, the woman at the Jet Propulsion Library. She says, Lily's story is my attempt to draw some of this history out from the margins, to unerase the stories of women like Crystal Zhang and Merle Wu and Dr. Margaret Chung. Lily's story is entirely fiction and not based on theirs, but I imagine that she and these real women all had to deal with similar challenges, learning how to live as both Chinese American and lesbian in spaces that often did not allow both to coexist.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like the thesis of the book.
Yeah, the piece I read that she wrote goes into more detail about that same thing. So I'll just talk about that, and
yeah,
then you can
please
tell me about the book. But she writes, this is again on her as part of her notes from the Telegraph Club blog series. When I began the research for last night at the Telegraph Club in earnest, I knew I needed to know more about those lesbians of color. More specifically, I needed to know what it was like to be a Chinese American lesbian in San Francisco in the 1950s, but they were nearly invisible in the historical record. The few times I came across references to Asian American lesbians, they were mentioned in passing or relegated to the footnotes. She talks specifically about Merle Wu, who mm-hmm. is mentioned in one of those books that you mentioned,
yeah.
but only like a sentence. And so she had to she went back to the footnote, saw that it was part of an audio interview that had been recorded by somebody, and then tracked down the full audio interview to listen
sure.
to. That's the kind of stuff that she was doing. That meant that a lot of my research into the lives of queer Chinese American women in the 1950s felt like detective work. I tracked down every comment or footnote about a queer Chinese American person I could find, and I reached out to historians and academics to ask for leads. And then the full list of names, you mentioned three of them, I think. Dr. Margaret Chung, Mary Lee, Rose Bamberger, Crystal Zhang, Merle Wu, and Toy Yat Mar were the people she calls out specifically. They were doctors. They owned lesbian bars. They worked at department stores. They loved to go dancing. They read the Kinsey Report at the public library. They dressed in men's suits and sang on stage, and they held their girlfriend's hand at the club. All these women informed the character and world of Lily Hu, who would also likely declare that she was unfettered by tradition. But I think it's tradition, actually, that's the problem. Tradition has all too often decided that we don't belong in it, when in fact that's not true. We do, and we always have.
Yeah.
So, beyond the issue of, historical records being destroyed, even the ones that exist don't have a ton of information
about
the topic that she's looking for.
Good
so it's just it's interesting to read a bit about her chasing that down.
All of that to say,
mm-hmm.
and I think I tried to say this earlier if I did it a little overwinded, the book does not feel like you are reading this steeped in history, historical fiction, get your vegetables, learn about stuff book.
Yeah, it's consistently described as YA, which I think there's a certain amount of lightness or breeziness or at least
non-derogatory.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Because the notes I have are it is propelled by this trio of characters. We have Lily Hu, who's our main character. We have Shirley, her erstwhile best friend, her high school friend that she's been friends with forever. And we have Kath or Kathleen, as we first meet her, who is a girl that has been in school with them the whole time, but Lily only becomes friends with their senior year and starts to develop feelings for over the course of the novel. And their kind of triangle of you know, best friends that aren't really as good of friends as they thought they were,
mm-hmm.
when a relationship enters the scene and it's a relationship that kind of changes how people even think about one another. All of that stuff feels very contemporary and modern to me. Not to say that that wasn't a thing people were going through in the 50s, but it certainly doesn't feel like I'm reading a book from the 50s, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yes, there's a school dance where people pass out punch, and there is a beauty pageant and things, you know, things, but it's not all like poodle skirts and,
right, is anybody, you know, like dancing on a flagpole or whatever?
No,
like,
yeah.
It's okay.
It reminds me of the way, I don't remember, I don't think you were as high on the show as some of us were, Andrew. Babylon Berlin.
It was fine.
But
we stopped watching like midway through the third season.
The third season was not, it was fine. I didn't like it as much as one and two.
The show was okay. It was fine.
But the feeling I had watching especially the first season of that show is that, like, yes, it's a work of historical fiction, but all of the sensibilities are very modern. Like, the characters feel very compelling to a modern audience in terms of, like, how they think about the world, and the performances feel very electric and things like that. Like, that mm-hmm. was the thing that kept coming to mind as I was reading this novel, where it was like, yeah, these all feel like characters I would find in a book written about 21st century teens. They just happen to live in this time period. And I don't mean that to say that it sounds incongruous. It's just their voices don't feel old and stolid and you know,
sure,
that kind of,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So before we get into the book, Andrew, what do you just tell me about San Francisco? I've never been there.
Frisco, you mean?
Yeah, tell me about the old Frisco Bay.
People call it Frisco. It's, yeah, like 65 always.
Yep.
I haven't been there since before the pandemic, and my understanding is that it's maybe like maybe some of the problems that it's had have gotten exacerbated. Just like there's a lot of like housing inequality,
yeah,
income
there is.
Inequality,
yep.
Like a lot of they've been dealing with a lot of like endemic systemic problems for a long time. But I don't know. I like it better in L.A.
That's kind of what I hear about it, is that it's better than L.A.
That sounds like damning with faint praise, maybe. But I don't know. I like Frisco. I've been to they got an aquarium I like. They got a big bridge.
Yeah, sure.
Golden one.
It's a golden one. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mostly know it through movies and TV. I've never been there.
Were you hoping for like a specific? It's very like hilly there. It's very hilly.
I just wanted to know what you thought. You know, I've never been there. So as the person on the podcast who's ever been to San Francisco, I figured you should weigh in.
I started like, because I usually would be out there for like Apple events, and
yeah,
in, like, the like mid 2010s, they were mostly doing their events in San Francisco. Like the Moscone Center is,
yes,
the big,
yes,
like a place where all the tech companies would have their conferences and stuff, and then they'd have stuff at like theaters and whatever. And then later in the 2010s, they start doing all their stuff closer to their campus, so you'd be going to San Jose instead, and San Jose sucks. So like that definitely made me appreciate San Francisco more.
All right.
Was having to go to San Jose a bunch.
Just, we're gonna spend the rest of this episode in San Francisco effectively. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just get you in the right headspace.
Yeah,
appreciating it as a place, but maybe not loving it.
Yeah, no, it's I wouldn't move there, but I enjoyed spending, you know, a few days there on the company's dime mostly.
Yes. Yeah, definitely, right?
Yeah, not Apple's dime, my employer's dime.
Yeah,
just to make sure that there's no like ethical questions.
Oh yeah, no ethical questions here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if Apple wants to send me to San Francisco, we could talk. Ethical questions abound. Let's break apart the title of this book.
Okay.
Last night, she said, "Oh baby." No, you know, I don't know the rest of the words to that song. The book is set in 1954, 1955. The primary last night of the title, I think, is New Year's-ish, like the day before New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'll talk about what the Telegraph Club is. But over a winter break while Lily is in high school, she is her senior year of high school, she makes some trips to the Telegraph Club, and one of them goes poorly. That is, I think, the titular last night. But Lily is living in this era where, as I've said, the Chinese population has a lot of pressures on it from the U.S. government. Also, there's kind of this just strong assimilation, but that leads to a strong feeling of like needing to assimilate into white American culture.
Yeah.
Even as like Lily talks about, she goes to high school where, you know, winds up going to a school where there are non-Chinese people there. There are plenty of Chinese people there from Chinatown, but it is still kind of a change for her. And then when she goes to a couple other places in the area, whether it be the Macy's or when she finally goes to the Telegraph Club, like, she is often the only or one of two or three Chinese people in those, or Chinese American people in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So like that is an ever present part of the novel.
Okay.
And yeah, the it's the senior year for some girls living in San Francisco. That is like,
and would you say the city is like a character in the book? Craig?
I don't know that I would. Not
would you say the high school is a character in the book?
Who's I would
the,
not say the high school is. I would say maybe the Telegraph Club is.
Okay, sure.
I would say maybe Chinatown is.
Ooh, okay.
But the larger sense of like, I don't know, maybe reflective of Lily's experience is that I don't come away from the book with a real strong sense of San Francisco outside of Chinatown and the immediate like environs outside of it.
Yeah, I mean that's just kind of cities, though, you know.
That's true. You have kind of a provincial is not the right word, but kind of a, maybe it is. You're part of the city is your part of the city. Like that's your experience of the city.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay. I see.
You would know the parts that you spent a bunch of time in, and you would not know the parts that you did not spend a bunch of time in. Like. When you say you're from, like, even when you say you're from Philadelphia, like, Philadelphia is kind of, like, stupidly big and, like, geographically diverse in a lot of ways.
It is.
We both live in the city limits and yet have very different, there's just, like, the style of houses is different, like, the topography is different, like, the vegetation is mostly pretty different. It's weird.
I don't know. Okay. Quick tangent. Laura and I were watching an episode of House Hunters the other day.
On a podcast? A tangent?
I know. Laura and I were watching an episode of House Hunters the other day, and it was set in Philadelphia. Now, House Hunters is a fraud of a show. We know this.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were looking at three houses in Philadelphia, and it was like, we were both going to go to bed, but we had to stay up to find out like what quote unquote neighborhoods they were going to. It was just fascinating because it's like, no, Fishtown is a real neighborhood.
Yeah.
South Philly, they never got more specific than South Philly. And that's really broad. And I don't know where they were.
Yeah. At a bare minimum, need to talk about which side of Broad Street you're on.
Which side of Broad? Are you north or south of Washington?
Of Washington. Yeah.
And then the third house was in Drexel Hill, which is Philly-ish,
I guess, more burby.
It is, and that was the thing. It's like, well, does he want a yard in the burbs? You know, it's that kind of thing. They settled for the place in Fishtown. It was fine.
Okay. Well, I mean, now they have to live in Fishtown.
And now they have to live in Fishtown.
It's
you know,
too bad for them.
But it was just one of those things. To your point, where it's just like, I wonder what version of Philly those people are going to live in. Anyway,
for people outside of Philadelphia who don't know about our derogatory thing about Fishtown, if you read stories around the 2020 election or like the George Floyd protests about just like vigilante groups of people who were friends with cops wandering the streets with like baseball bats, that was Fishtown.
They were coming down from the far northeast, I think. I don't know. Parts of Fishtown are cool. Parts of Fishtown are cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's Northern Liberties.
Northern Liberties. No, you can't say no libs.
It is called No Libs, which has its own. Oh boy. Anyway, the Telegraph Club. I'm talking about the novel of this book, The Telegraph Club.
Mm-hmm.
This is another thing that made me think of Babylon Berlin. It's a performance club, or my notes say a performance club.
Performance club. Okay, you wrote that with your human brain, I assume.
I think I'm trying to make a distinction that it is not a dance club. It is not a club.
Right. Yeah. It's like a nightclub.
It is a nightclub. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, performance club.
Because as Melinda Lowe writes in her afterword, Elvis hasn't happened yet, really. Like, we're not fully into rock and roll as the dominant musical art form of pop music. So we're still dealing with kind of crooners, not quite jazz singers, but like, you know, folks are going to get out and sing a standard and work a crowd.
Old Blue Eyes.
Yes. And the Telegraph Club is a fictional club that Lowe made up, but it is, you know, riffing on existing clubs that were back there in that time period. And it is headlined by someone named Tommy Andrews. Lily finds an ad for Tommy Andrews in a newspaper and kind of loses it because Lily, as we come to learn, is, you know, discovering that she is attracted to women and she doesn't quite know what to do with those feelings.
Sure.
There's a prologue where she is 13 and she's at a Miss Chinatown competition, you know, beauty pageant with her friend Shirley. And she like has a beat where she's like, am I allowed to be looking at all of these girls in this pageant? Like, she's just kind of like recognizing that it is stirring something and not quite sure what to do with those, because literally no one in her life is talking about what would happen if that were the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so she kind of loses it over this Tommy Andrews ad because Tommy Andrews is a male impersonator.
Okay.
And the whole thing is really intriguing to her.
Mm-hmm.
A woman is going to perform dressed as a man. She's kind of attracted to this photo of Andrews that she finds in the paper. And when later in the novel we finally do get to the club, it is like a classic kind of, it's not a drag show as we would understand it today, of course. And it is not even really drag in nature at all. But it is like Tommy Andrews is a woman dressing as a man on purpose, but also like still reminding you that she's a woman so that you watch that part of her as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that there are a lot of lesbians who frequent the club, though that's not the only clientele, though there are not very many Chinese or Asian folks there.
Mm-hmm.
Some other folks of color, but when Lily is there, she is often the only Chinese person there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's described as like, Tommy Andrews usually does two sets, and like all of the tourists stay for the first set, like all the straight people stay for the first set and then they leave. And then the second set is much gayer, and like,
okay,
she will change lyrics in the second set to like make them gayer than she will in the first set.
That makes some amount of sense. Like, you would, there would probably be like unspoken sort of program changes that would happen to emphasize different things for different audiences.
Yeah, something that other...
I bet a straight person new to this club stays for the second set the first time. They're like, I don't know if this is my... I'm welcome in right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lowe does mention in her author's note something that, like, just the history of San Francisco, like
Frisco,
of Frisco, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the food that's from Frisco?
Rice-a-roni?
Thank you. Okay. thank you for knowing exactly what I was wondering about.
Yeah. You're
with me. Nightclubs, yeah. Rice-a-roni. Welcome to my Rice-a-roni nightclub.
Welcome to Frisco.
Lowe talks about it being this kind of post-war boom, you know, all these people moving there for work during the war. Obviously, there were, you know, it being a port city, there was a lot of infrastructure that needed to be built. That's why there was a lot of Chinese labor there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then once there is this big population there that, you know, both through the armed forces and kind of hangers on from that, there becomes this big tourist culture. There becomes a lot of underground queer culture and not so underground queer culture, just because there are so many like new people in a new spot.
Yeah.
Which kind of explodes what the city is doing.
Yeah. You say it's a port city, but I just wanted to point out that there's a lot of different kinds of wine in California and in San Francisco. And you don't just have to have a port.
You can have a nice Chianti. If you don't want it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Some fava beans.
A Chianti city.
We probably won't talk about in the rest of this podcast. Throughout the novel, there are a series of what my notes call jump back chapters. What am I doing?
jump back? Do you mean a flashback?
Sort of. the primary chapters of the novel all follow Lily and her perspective, though every 10 or so chapters we get an interlude chapter that focuses on one of the adults in her life, either
yes.
her mother, Grace, her dad, Joseph, or her aunt, Judy.
So she mentioned this in an interview. Like suggestions from her from the adult's perspective, she had assumed, I guess, for a YA book that people just did not, she just didn't, she wasn't allowed, quote unquote, to put in like adults.
Oh, weird.
You know, in the book. But her editor said, you should do this. And she talked about it as like, I think it was the Autostraddle interview. And she and the interviewer were talking about how like parents don't understand teens, but teens also don't understand their parents.
That's
so
smart.
It's, yeah. So you put in this perspective so that everybody, like whether you're reading it as an adult or reading it as, you know, someone in the age
yes.
group that it's like, quote unquote, for, you are getting a chance to like be outside of your own perspective a little bit, which is kind of neat.
I dig it. Yeah. So I'm not going to
more, but more writing as a reader, I think I would classify
yeah,
that as
sure. Yeah. Cause they do, they help some of the historical perspective of the novel. Like, Grace, Lily's mom, is born in America. Joseph is born in China. So when they first meet each other, they are, you know, one of them is speaking Cantonese, one of them is speaking Mandarin. Joseph at first doesn't know that she was born in America and kind of comes to learn that. And so you get snippets of the various immigrant experiences, as well as a little bit more of the awareness of kind of racism, anti-Chinese racism in America. There's a scene in one of the Judy chapters, I think it's Judy, it might be Grace, where they go to like a museum, they take Lily to a museum where there's like animatronics of history, and one of them is like a Chinese opium den that's like a nightmare. It's just like ghastly in its racism. And
this is the worst Chuck E. Cheese I've ever been to.
Truly, yeah. And all in all, I think those novels, they help humanize these characters without like needing to weave like subplots throughout the novel about them, right? Which I think the tight focus on our main character is both just a smart choice for what Lo is writing, but also is kind of a genre and, you know, a YA choice, right? To just focus on a character that the reader can identify with.
Sure.
The end of the novel, if you are with Lily through and through, you're going to be pretty mad at these three adult characters at the end of this book. Like, if you are just in Lily's corner. And so I think one of the other things that these chapters do is just like humanize them a bit in advance of that happening, so that like,
right
when
so that they're not just like cartoon characters when they end up doing a thing that you don't like.
For real. So okay, what's the deal with Lily? She is in high school, she's a senior, she's kind of a nerd, but not in like, you know, not in like a 80s nerd way, you know, like she's not a cartoon nerd is what I'm saying.
What kind of a nerd is she, though?
Well, she's like into sci-fi books and also into science fact. Like, she's interested in engineering and math and things like that.
Sci-fi and sci-fi.
Yeah, she wants to... like, no one has called it that. Oh, no. She wants to go into engineering. She wants to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That's like her dream. As I've said, she's got this best friend, Shirley. She's known Shirley all her life. There's a thing that they have where they like, when they see strangers out in the world, sometimes they'll like make a little backstory for them and kind of play like a little improv game with each other about who that person is and why they exist wherever they're existing at that moment.
Sure.
It's a fun little device when it crops up two or three times later in the book, you get like a different shade of the relationship each time. And I think at a macro level, this is reminding me that like this is a book where I don't always experience this for the show, where I'm reading a book and going like, oh, that's a nice thing that the author did. Like, that's a clever thing that they did to make the character work or something. I feel like I'm a little more attuned to that in, you know, I'm definitely more attuned to that in theater and sometimes in movies and sometimes in TV. But sometimes I can turn that off when I'm reading books for the show. And it was like, I don't mean that as a, oh, I could see all the tropes as I was reading
right,
it.
Right.
It just, it actually made it work more for me.
I think you made me think of the main character in the Rebecca Yarros book, the dragon romance book, Fourth Wing.
Yeah.
Because she did that thing where she did all the fantasy book exposition, but she did it because she recites facts about the universe to calm herself. And it's not about like, oh, I see this trope coming and it's just well handled. It's just like this kind of book has to do some of this.
Yep.
And the author went into this knowing that and handled it in a clever way.
Yes.
Again, writing as a reader, I think.
And there's a couple different things that she does throughout the book, like this Lily and Shirley have a little improv game that they do together that when we see it over the course of the book, we can use it to chart their friendship and how healthy it is, kind of thing.
That
struck me as like, wow, yeah, you know what you're doing. Dang, okay, cool.
Yeah, it's like it's we're so smart and cool and well read that we notice it, but you can kind of appreciate how a different reader who hadn't been reading to make content out of it for 11 years, how they wouldn't even kind of see the strings, and you can appreciate the craft of not being able to see the strings.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Shirley is fine, but she's a little overbearing, and you know, that definitely their friendship is kind of born out of circumstance. She's also interested in this guy named Calvin, an older guy who maybe hooked up with some young communist stuff.
Okay.
She drags Lily to like a picnic at one point with Calvin and his friends, and someone sees Lily there, and it definitely comes back to her parents that like the FBI were trailing these kids.
Oh man, come on.
And come now on, Lily's parents are at risk of like deportation if he doesn't like sign a statement swearing that this kid is a communist kind of stuff.
Oh boy.
That type of thing could be what the plot of the book is about, but Melinda Lowe says, no, 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 no. That's just a thing that all of the characters are now afraid of. Like, we don't encounter another FBI agent in the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. It's just, it is now a thing that everyone is aware of the precariousness of the situation.
Yeah.
And we will move on. Kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think we've given some of these female body inspectors too much too much leeway. We've given them too much power. That's what it stands for, right? I've seen it on a t-shirt.
I know, that's an acronym. I always kind of forget what it stands for until I see it again.
Yeah,
you
right.
know. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of other ones like that.
Yes, but on the t-shirt of a 27-year-old straight white man.
It's sort of like when you see the FedEx arrow for the first time in a while. Yeah, like, wow, right. That's there, mm-hmm. huh? Okay. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Lily is also discovering that she is a lesbian. She encounters this, you know, lesbian pulp novel in a thrift store. Every time in the book when she is presented with an opportunity to hide who she is or kind of learn more about who she is and then maybe tell someone about it, she always chooses the latter. She always chooses like embrace the truth of it, which is something that I think is both I think it's why a lot of people like this book or love this book, especially if they are a queer person who is like seeing themselves in this book,
mm-hmm.
because you have this character who a lot of storytelling tropes are going to have this character like hide herself
mm-hmm.
and conflict is going to arise from that, and that's what the plot is.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it's a book about her moving more and more towards herself, which is kind of really compelling. Mm-hmm. and it still creates conflict and still creates drama and things like that. So that's what I really like about the book. Here's the passage that made me think about that.
Okay.
She's reading this book about lesbian women and she's like never read anything like this before and is confused. She knew that what she had read in Strange Season was not only scandalous, it was perverse. She should feel dirtied by reading it. She should feel guilty for being thrilled by it. The problem was she didn't. She felt as if she had finally cracked the last part of a code she had been puzzling over for so long that she couldn't remember when she had started deciphering it. She felt exhilarated. And when I was preparing my notes for this episode, that passage connects to what I really love about the end of the novel,
mm-hmm.
when she has to come out to her parents and explain, you know, I'll talk about what the drama is there, but she has to kind of explain the situation that she's in. And plenty of probably good books that I'm just not, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, have had a character shy away from, you know, telling the truth to her parents in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Melinda Lowe has her be like, no, 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 I could do that. Or I could tell the truth, and I will tell the truth, and, you know, and then see what happens. And
yeah,
it just really, it felt really fresh and compelling.
Yeah, because yeah, I think
trait.
If you're watching TV or a movie or reading a book or whatever that's like historical fiction but gay,
I think the
impulse of a lot of the characters is to hide it, to be clandestine about it in some way. So to have a character who's not doing that is a more interesting narrative choice, I think, at least insofar as it's not employed as much.
Yeah, and it's not to say that she doesn't do clandestine things in the novel. So like the girl that she's going to meet and then develop a relationship, Kathleen, who once she finally spends time with her is like, hey, you can call me Kath. And then the book refers to her as Kath, like in the prose throughout, which is kind of a nice little touch. They strike up a friendship when they're in a group together in a class called Senior Goals, where they are supposed to, in a group, outline their senior goals.
No, I see in your goals.
Oh, my God. I would hate to be in your group. And Shirley, ostensibly Lily's friend, Lily is talking about how she's going to go to college. And Shirley's like, are you sure you're college material? And Kathleen, who is not close to either of them at this point, says, well, Cal takes anyone in the top 15% of their graduating class. I'm not going to have a problem. Neither will Lily, but I don't think we'll see you there.
Ooh, burn.
And Lily's like, huh, that's kind of fun. Lily then gets asked to the dance by Will, who Shirley has been pushing on her. And Lily, because she is discovering her sexuality, kind of flips out and doesn't know how to say no to him and runs into the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathleen is in there and is like, hey, I'll just go tell him you're having woman troubles. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And he runs away.
Mm-hmm.
And
nothing scarier to a man, especially in the 1950s.
Oh, truly. There's like a Will-sized hole in the wall. He's like, mm-hmm. out of there.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a will there, won't they? I don't know what's wrong with me.
but so they, you know, and Lily thanks her and then they walk home together and Kathleen mm-hmm. is like, hey, call me Kath. And so they start walking home together and, you know, Lily asks Kath to show up at the dance, even though Lily is like working the punch table, and they hang out together at the dance on their own, and they make a plan to go to the Telegraph Club together and things like that. But it is all, at this point, it is all hidden. But to what I was saying earlier, any time that this like kind of comes to a head where Lily is caught or someone confronts her, instead of coming up with some sort of ruse or trying to shirk away, she does like meet it head on. It is not that she is like, she is behaving as she would historically, right?
Mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
terms of like, well, she knows that there are people who she would get in trouble for, you know, being openly homosexual in some situations. So she's like, well, I should hide that. I should blah, 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 blah. But then when it's like, well, I could lie about who I am or mm-hmm. I could tell people the truth. She always mm-hmm. chooses that.
Mm-hmm.
The club is fun. They meet other lesbians.
How often are they in this club? Like what kind of stuff are they getting up to in this club?
They go, I want to say they go maybe three or four times over the course of the novel.
Okay.
And yes, they are, you know, teens. So they're there and like drinking beer and stuff, even though they shouldn't be. Like, you know, people recognize that they're a little young to be there. Kath has been there before with another girl named Jean, who Shirley, you know, warns Lily about. Like, well, Kathleen was friends with Jean, and Jean, you know, people found out she's a lesbian, and so be careful.
Okay.
So Shirley is not cool. Shirley stinks. I mean, whatever. I wish Shirley stunk less is basically how I left the novel. But
yeah, surely the book would have been different if.
So they go to this club, and I like how a couple elements of this are handled. I referenced earlier the, like, you know, the Tommy Andrews performance stuff, which I think all really works well. It's very overwhelming for Lily. Like, when she first sees this person perform, she doesn't even know what to do with how she's feeling about
it. Right, yeah, because it's like, it's both discovering something about yourself, but also, like, not being aware that this even was a thing before, and now yes. Now it is a thing, and you're like, what?
I can't remember. I think so. She's been hanging out with Kath for a little while, and at one point, Kath is like, "Hey, can you come with me? Like, can you come with me to bowling? Like, I will show up at this weird dance for you if you come with me on this like after school bowling club with like this girls bowling association." Mm-hmm. And while they're bowling, there are a bunch of pervs at the bowling alley who are like, "Haha, girls bowling." Their skirts go up, right? Huh. And
so it's just like, it's like regular bowling alley.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Lily is like keenly aware of like this kind of terrible male gaze thing. So when she is watching Tommy Andrews, she's like, this is what she says. Lily felt a queasy, self-conscious confusion. It was wrong to stare, and yet Tommy was on stage, and they were supposed to look. It would be rude not to watch, so she did. So she's, like, wrapping up her own, like, I'm very attracted to this, but I don't know what that means. But also, I think being, you know, leering is lewd and bad, and yet this person wants me to look at them. Like, she's just kind of working through all of this stuff in a way I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And while they're there, they're meeting other lesbian couples who are, I think most of them are like early 20s. Some of them are college students at the oldest. Maybe some of them are like late 20s, early 30s.
Okay.
There's a remark towards the end of the novel where Tommy Andrews' girlfriend, Lily, is staying at her apartment, and she compares her to her aunt, and she's like, wow, my aunt is like actually real older than this lady. Like, I thought this lady was like really elegant and, you know, had her stuff together, and next to my aunt, she's like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I really like about the multiple trips to the Telegraph Club gets to a thing you referenced in the notes from the Telegraph Club, is that they meet these different lesbian characters. Most of them don't ever become consequential characters in the plot of the novel. But then, like, after two or three visits, Lily winds up at the Macy's again shopping for a dress with Shirley, I think. And one of the young women is there, like, working at the Macy's.
Right.
And mm-hmm. It's just this little beat of, like, the worlds are colliding. These people are real. Like, this is a real place I'm going, and the people there actually exist in the world, and like that is affirming and strange for her.
I think that that's an interesting way to use the, because as she said, you know, in that piece, she's having to dig through the footnotes and the margins to find these people. They're probably, even once you find records of them, they probably aren't very detailed.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's an interesting way to have them in the book, but to keep it feeling real, to just like not make up a bunch of stuff about
them.
Correct. Like you see them in the periphery of the novel, because that's kind of how they exist in the historical record, but that feels like well employed as part of the narrative thing.
And it's an interesting balance to how you encounter them in the club, where Lily and Kath, whenever they're at the club, they're like the people who talk the least. Like, they get invited to sit at a table with some other folks who are very comfortable there. And, like, I think when we meet, this might be Paula, I think is her name. She's talking to another person about, like, movies they've seen or other books that they've read or something that has like queer characters in it that they're talking about. And Lily, of course, doesn't know anything about it. So she's, you know, yeah, very quiet. Mm-hmm. And then you go out in the world, you bump into her while, your straight friend is over there trying on dresses for a beauty pageant. And you're like, see you later. And you're just kind of like, well, I guess we both exist out here outside the club. Very strange for all of us. But you're right. It does kind of like paint this broader picture of like the society exists. People are in it, you know?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
The back half of the novel is kind of the push and pull of the triangle of characters where during an air raid drill, it's the 50s.
Yeah,
just hide under your desk in case of a nuclear bomb.
I mean, I'd stood under an archway of a door today because of the earthquake.
Yes,
day.
We're recording this on Earthquake Day. Yeah.
Those school drills do really like become part of your part of your DNA in some way that you don't really know about until you're put in that position.
It's very strange. But so Shirley and Lily are kind of bonding during this drill, making some light of it to cope, which kind of breaks the ice. They've been on the outs since Shirley warned her very emphatically about Kath, and Lily didn't really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start spending time again together when Shirley is like, I think I want to run for the Miss Chinatown pageant. Like, I think I want to compete in this pageant. And Lily is like, this morning you actually told me. There's a bit where Shirley's like, what if we weren't Chinese? Do you ever wish you weren't Chinese? Ever wish you didn't live in Chinatown? Mm-hmm. And she's the only character who voices something like that. And what she says that she really means by that is she wants to be out of this kind of cloistered, oppressive, gossipy neighborhood.
Sure.
That has become that as a coping mechanism for all of the external forces on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she really views it as this gossip monster, which she wields against Lily later in the book. But that's where they're going. And then the other track is Lily being like, oh, I've gotten friendly with Shirley again, but that means I've been like sleeping on my friendship with Kath, and let me get back to that.
Yeah.
And they like have a real relationship and it blossoms, and like it involves them like sneaking around school, finding places to make out, and it's really charming. And I don't know, it's like I really liked reading all those chapters of them because it is a mix of them sharing just like who they are with each other, but also just the like rush of, oh my God, I really like this person. I'm physically attracted to them. What do I do with it?
Uh-huh.
And for both of them, it is a pretty new thing to do with a woman also, like the, mm-hmm. you know, all mm-hmm. of that. They don't have I think Kath has a bit more of a frame of reference for it, but
sure.
As we kind of wrap up here, I'll speed run the end here. The club gets raided at one point while the girls are there. And Kath and Lily get separated. Kath gets arrested. Lily has no idea what's happened to her.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a newspaper article about it. Also, Shirley, but doesn't mention them, but, you know, Lily knows that this article exists.
Yeah.
And then Shirley confronts Lily and is like, someone in Chinatown saw you leaving the club that night. They know you were there. They're going to talk about it to people. That's a problem. And how could you hide this from me? How did this happen to you?
Sure.
Giving her multiple opportunities to be like, oh my God, Kath took me there against my will, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, throw other people under the bus in the interest of keeping the peace or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Lily refuses, you know, shuts the door on Shirley entirely. And Lily is like, oh my God, the gossip monster is going to destroy me. I could wait for that to tell my parents and family, or I could tell them myself. And there's mm-hmm. this really difficult chapter where she tells her mom herself. Her mom does not know what to do with that information. And Lily runs away, spends some time at Tommy Andrews' girlfriend's house, is brought back by her aunt. Really rough chapter, where like the family is in town for the holidays and Lily has to pretend that none of this is happening.
Yeah.
That chapter's like, it just emotionally sucked. Like, it's just really rough to read. I put it under the rug.
That having not lived that experience myself, but knowing people who have to deal, like, you, once or twice a year, you just have to be around your family member who's a real knob about
like, everything,
your identity.
Yep.
Like, I have a secondhand understanding of how much that sucks.
And then it builds to her parents being like, okay, you're going to finish the school year with your aunt in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. You're going away.
Yeah.
And that to me is the, like, is Melinda Lowe's nod to the trope of the pulp lesbian novel where, like, they don't immediately get a happy ending.
Yeah.
It's not terrible. She's not, like, sent to jail. Her parents don't fully disown her or anything like that. But they are like, you cannot be here because you keep, we gave you opportunities to say this wasn't happening and you refused to do that. So,
right. And you spent the entire novel discovering yourself in these
yep.
like, specific places and with these specific people. And we are sending you away from them because
yep.
maybe if you're away from the places and people, you won't be like this anymore.
Well, and you get this hint from the two of them. Which, again, you've been humanized through the historical chapters, as I called them. What did I call them?
The jump back chapters? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where they, you know, say, we want... They can't envision a world where she, in a lesbian relationship, will have a family, will have, you know, younger people in her life who will care for her when she's older. Like, they just can't picture that. Their imagination does not stretch that far. And so they think that they are acting in her best interest, yada, 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 all that garbage. And they send her away with Judy. And in the car, Judy's like, I don't know this. I will do my best to be a person that can help you with this as you, you know, move through it. And it's like an interesting moment. And it kind of ends on a downer note, and then you get an epilogue, which is like, she's been a year, she went to college, she's in college now, she comes back to town for the holidays, and she has, like, a really lovely evening at dinner with Kath, and they, like, reconnect, and it's very moving, and it's clear that, like, they're gonna have some sort of relationship, at least for the near future.
Yeah.
So it's a nice little corrective to the trope from Lowe, but also kind of acknowledging the trope at the same time.
Yeah. That's smart.
And that's the book. The only other thing I haven't talked about is that, like, she, in addition to the jump back chapters, she puts in these little timeline snippets where she will, it'll be like, here's a thing that Joseph McCarthy did. Here's a thing that the Supreme Court did. Here's a thing that Lily did, like, in a couple of years. And similarly, she does it for the older characters whenever she is jumping back. And it's just one of the ways that she can, like, include the research and historical record that she does without it having to be the, you know, the actual text of the novel.
Yeah, sure.
It reminds me of things that I've helped put together for a lot of theater productions where you see a timeline in the program or the lobby or the study guide where you're like, here's all of the historical events that are relevant to this story, and then here are all the plot beats that go along that timeline, so that you kind of get a sense of how they intersect.
Mm-hmm.
I got to shout out, Andrew.
Okay. Thank you for shouting me out.
Well, you're right. Got to shout you out.
Thank you. That's really flattering. I
don't know if there's anything any reviews you read that we didn't cover, but I do want to shout out two Common Sense Media reviews that I read from kids.
Common Sense Media reviews.
One who's from kid, 12 years old.
From Chrono Cross.
Yeah, who said it was a great book, a really important book. I really liked this book, but there was definitely too much sex. There was some drinking and smoking, but it wasn't too bad. Overall, it was a really good book. But I think you might want to wait to read it until high school.
All the people in this book were too cool, and I didn't like it.
Jamie, 14 said, "This was such a beautiful, well-written book. Lily and Kath are great role models for young queer and lesbian girls. While they do sneak out and drink and smoke, I would assume most children 12 and above would know those were unsafe things to do. There is some capital S sex, but as long as kids know this is a capital S serious topic and discussion, they should be fine. Many young girls could benefit from a positive representation of a lesbian relationship, whether they are out and proud as a lesbian, still in the closet, figure things out, or even just to see they are people just like everyone else." Thank you, Jamie.
I do understand that for a Common Sense Media review,
you got to talk about how much sex is happening.
That kind of stuff is why people are going to the site. Uh-huh. And I don't... You know, my kid is 4. So, like, I am not, this is not a thing that I'm dealing with firsthand, but I completely understand wanting to introduce your child to those topics, but wanting to do it in a controlled way that you kind of know what's going on. Even if you are just like lying to yourself about how much control you have over that situation. But nevertheless, these reviews do sound like they're complaining about how cool all the characters are.
Yep. This book was beautiful, except the characters were a little too cool for me.
The characters were just like riding skateboards and smoking big blunts all the time, and it was way too cool.
I was really into the book.
As long as you go into it understanding that this is for cool older kids, you'll really like it.
I was really into the book until one character played Smoke on the Water on the guitar, and mm-hmm. I had to put it down. It was too cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, until one character hit all the high notes in like a Lady Gaga song at karaoke, and it was too cool for me.
But that's Last Night at the Telegraph.
What's cool? Club. I think we're revealing kind of the limits of what we know of as cool in 2024. Like Olivia Rodrigo, maybe I should update
she
my references.
She is cool, actually. Yeah, no, she's cool. I do. Now. Yeah. I like her a lot. She is pretty cool. Well, that's you why I said the guitar, but maybe I should not have used Smoke on the Water is the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I just had made the weed joke, so.
Yeah, but people have been smoking weed for a long time.
Word association, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, people have been cool since the olden times.
Yeah!
Since the pyramids, people have been, super cool.
The pharaohs, famously super cool guys.
Yeah, super cool.
Anyway, thanks for letting me tell you about this book, Andrew.
You're welcome. Thank you for telling me about it.
I think people would enjoy it if they read it, even if they listen to me spoil the ending. Even though it's not really a spoiler, it's just what happens.
And then they listen to me interrupt you to say the stupidest stuff they've ever heard while you're trying to talk about the book.
No, you said smart stuff. I said stuff like jump back chapters. Mm-hmm. So
it bounces out.
If you have any thoughts on Melinda Lowe or on this book or on Frisco, you can send them overduepod@gmail.com or post to our various social media pages. We try to be active on Blue Sky and Instagram at overduepod. Thanks to Robert, Claire, Allison, Liesl, Jamie, Rosalind, Kate, Rochelle, Jillian, Marcy, and more for reaching out in the past week. Our theme song is composed by Nick Larandris. Andrew, folks want to know more about the show, where do they go?
Overduepodcast.com is our internet website. We have the schedule for the month of April up there now, all kinds of fun stuff on that. We also have links to all the podcast download services that Craig's mentioned in the social sites. Patreon.com/overduepod is our Patreon page. Support us there financially. You buy us books, you buy us equipment, you put our kids in school and daycare, depending on which kid you're talking about.
I got a message from daycare on Earthquake Day that said, "The kids are just fine."
So you did that. You patrons did that. Thank you so much. Patreon.com/overduepod. You also get access to our Discord server, bonus episodes early, our long read project about Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad, all that stuff and more. Mm-hmm. Patreon.com/overduepod. Next week, on April 15th, tax day, I'm reading the book Holes by Louis Sachar.
Sacker rhymes with cracker.
Sacker rhymes with cracker. Interesting. Good to know.
Yeah.
I know one more thing about Louis Sacker now than I did just a minute ago.
There's
I'm already learning stuff.
Website that somebody sent to us, school.teachingbooks.net. Mm-hmm. I will just shout it out here. They have a bunch of authors there, and they have recordings of them pronouncing their own names. It's a resource that I'm increasingly using for the show.
That's good.
And if you are a teacher, you might want to go there and Sacker rhymes with cracker.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the book Holes, which is about holes.
I'm interested to learn more about these holes.
To learn more about holes? Yeah, same. Me too. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to our show. And until we talk to you female body inspectors next week, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.